Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a podcast I've been looking very much forward to sharing with you because it's about a subject that we really need to get the word out about. The subject is SIBO, S-I-B-O, and it sounds a little bit like a good name for a Brazilian bossa nova group, SIBO. But actually, SIBO is of great importance because tens of millions of Americans suffer from SIBO, and it's the cause of a great deal of distress, and it undermines our health. And we're going to talk to one of the world's experts on the subject of SIBO. We'll explain in just a moment. She is Allison Seebecker. She's a naturopathic physician, and she also has a master's degree in oriental medicine, and she's been working in the nutritional field continuously since the 1980s, and she currently also is at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, where she conducts research, and she educates naturopathic physicians in training as well as physicians. She is currently writing a book on SIBO, and she also is a recipient of the Best in Naturopathy Award from the Townsend Letter for her article, Traditional Bone Broth in Modern Health and Disease. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on. So without further ado, here's Dr. Seebecker. Welcome, Allison. Nice having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Have I missed anything in terms of describing your background?
Oh, I think it was long enough.
Okay. Did you play field hockey in high school, or did you go?
I didn't.
any trophies? Okay. So, but in particular, her focus since 2009 has been on small intestine bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, and she has a fabulous website. Everything you ever wanted to know about SIBO at SIBOinfo.com. SIBOinfo.com. So first of all, some definitions. What is SIBO?
So it's an abbreviation that stands for small intestine bacterial overgrowth. And it seems somewhat self-explanatory, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. But to understand it, what you need to know is that the small intestine is not supposed to have bacteria in it in very large amounts at all. And so it can just create a lot of havoc when there's too many there. So
help us out, though, because the intestine we tend to think of as a place where there are bacteria, but we'll distinguish then maybe from the anatomically for our listeners, the small intestine versus the large intestine.
Oh, yes, that's one of my favorite points, because it seems like, you know, we have these words, intestines and bowels, and they can apply to, and gut, which can apply to many organs, but intestine and bowel can apply to small intestine or large intestine. And it just seems like in most people's minds, they think about the large intestine when the word intestine or bowel is said. So the small intestine comes first, and it's not small, actually. It's very, very long, maybe up to about 22 feet, depending upon the size of the person. But it's narrow. It's more narrow in diameter than the large intestine. Large intestine is shorter but wider, and the small intestine is where we do digestion and absorption. And it's not supposed to have many bacteria because they would interfere with that process, which is what they do in SIBO. But in the large intestine, that's where we're supposed to have a lot of bacteria. That's normal, healthy.
It's sort of like a fermenting, large fermenting vat. In fact, it's supposed
sure
to
is.
Have the healthy blend of bacteria, the so-called microbiome, which is related to many aspects of health.
Yes, and just to get a little handle grasp on definition on SIBO, we could say it's when a lot of bacteria colonize the small intestine, and that's not proper. So that's basically what it is.
Okay. So but what could predispose to that? What are some of the conditions of life or modern life that cause many people to have, you know, it's like looking for love in all the wrong places? Here it's having bacteria in all the wrong places.
Yeah, okay, so I like to group the causes, why we can get this, into three big categories. And that would be, just overarchingly, would be slowed motility or movement in the small intestine itself, The second would be obstruction, so something blocking the downward passage in the small intestine. And the third would be, I would say, like little non-draining pockets. So that would be things like small intestine diverticuli, little outpouches or pockets on the small intestine that could accumulate bacteria that shouldn't be there. But really,
those are not the most common causes of SIBO, I think. Those are more in people who have a disease or might have a stricture due to Crohn's disease or something like that.
That's right, like obstruction. Sure, that's going to be stricture adhesions, maybe a tumor, maybe even excess mucus from cystic fibrosis. But these are not common. What's really common is the first one, the slowed motility. It turns out that's really the primary cause of SIBO, and there's really a primary cause of that, and then secondary causes. And so I'll just briefly mention that the primary cause of that is going to be actually from having a bout of gastroenteritis. So gastroenteritis would be stomach flu, food poisoning, or traveler's diarrhea. And it seems as though what happens after gastroenteritis in a large proportion of people is that the nerves can be damaged from that acute situation, such that in the small intestine, such that that motion, that normal downward motion that we're supposed to have to sweep the bacteria out of the small intestine, gets damaged. It's not able to happen very well. Some other common ways this can happen is after taking opiate painkilling drugs for some other reason, like a surgery. A lot of people have surgery, knee surgery, wrist surgery, whatever it is, and they have to take some painkillers. That can slow the motility, and some people don't recover from that, and the motility stays slowed. And the last one I'll mention that is common, not as common as the first one, would be some diseases that are actually more common, like diabetes and hypothyroid, quite common, Hashimoto's. This can also slow the motility in the small intestine.
So what happens is the bacteria that are normally confined to the large intestine then sometimes find their way upstream and colonize the small intestine?
That's exactly what happens, because they're always wanting to grow. They get food from the food we eat, and they're always wanting to flourish, and they can just sort of grow in all directions, including backward. But what would stop them from doing that normally would be this downward motion, as well as some other things too. But that downward motion, that what I'm referring to is the migrating motor complex, is what it's called. And not a lot of people know about it, but it's a kind of like a form of peristalsis, and it happens when we're fasting, so in between meals and overnight. And its purpose is to sweep clear bacteria out of the small intestine. So yeah, the large intestine bacteria can just flourish, grow backward up there. And also just bacteria that we normally would eat every day with our food and we swallow in the air, now they're not getting swept out either.
What about certain lifestyle features such as sedentary lifestyle or taking lots of acid-blocking medication or alternatively taking lots of antibiotics or taking too much alcohol, sugar, and toxic food? Can that also have an impact on SIBO?
Yeah, it can. The one that seems to be the biggest in all those that you mentioned, those were all great things you mentioned, thanks for saving me the job, is the proton pump inhibitors, the acid-blocking medications.
Yeah.
Particularly proton pump inhibitors, because they're a more extreme version of acid blockers. That has been correlated as a risk factor, a pretty major risk factor for developing SIBO. And that's because the acid in the stomach normally kills incoming bacteria. And so when we remove that, we're not killing as much incoming bacteria. But additionally, acid is necessary to stimulate a lot of the other processes in the small intestine. So it really messes things up. There's been quite a debate in the literature if how much those medicines really do predispose to SIBO. And finally, there was a recent review of all the studies and said, yeah, they really are a risk factor.
But so for our listeners, well, let's mention some names, Protonix, Prilosec, Prevacid, Nexium, Zegarid, and Dexilant. These are some of the Zegarid and Dexilant are newer versions of these medications.
Thank you.
Yeah, these are medications that, you may not recognize, that a lot of people are put on these medications for life. They're told, you have changes in your esophagus that could be precancerous, so you need to be on these medications for an entire lifetime. Well, there may be, we're not even quite sure because the trials have not been really very rigorous, we may be preventing esophageal cancer, but we may be setting people up for problems a little further downstream in the small intestine.
It's a real conundrum. It really is. I mean, if there are people that really need to be on these medicines, that's one thing. But as you know, the vast majority, I believe, of people that get put on proton pump inhibitors, it's not actually needed.
Yes.
And better interventions are available. So that is what's frustrating in that situation. But I want to get back to what you mentioned, some of the other things, because, you know, the sedentary lifestyle or, you know, eating a poor diet, a lot of people feel they worry that they got their SIBO because of that. And that is not an actual cause of SIBO. But what it could be is a predisposing factor amongst many others adding up, you know, making the terrain more hospitable to develop SIBO, so to speak. But one of the other ones you mentioned is taking a lot of antibiotics.
Yep.
That is something that, now, I can't say the exact pathophysiology, but certainly I have so many patients I see that have that in their background. It really does seem to disrupt things. And, you know, unfortunately, once you're an adult, you can't do anything about it. You didn't have the choice as a child. You were, you know, your parents made those choices for you. But if parents are listening, then, and I bet if they're listening to your show, Ron, then they already know to be quite careful about
giving
too many antibiotics, during one's life.
Absolutely. Do factors such as breastfeeding enter into the equation? Because we know that breastfeeding conditions the intestinal tract, introduces healthy flora, introduces immune factors. I mean, could it be have some priming effect in the predisposition, as you mentioned?
I believe towards this? You know, of course, there's no study on this. I mean, there's, of course, plenty of studies on showing the difference in the flora from breastfeeding and not breastfeeding, from C-section and vaginal birth, and also even from home birth and hospital birth. So those are all facts that the flora is negatively impacted by not breastfeeding, by C-section, and even by hospital birth in some cases. But there's no study to say that for sure is linked with SIBO, but I think it's a predisposing factor. I do. I think it is. So I think that can be one of the things that sets up a general weakness in the intestines that then allows some of these other assaults and affronts to have the effect next to the next person where it develops to SIBO.
Well, by now, many of our listeners are wondering to themselves, okay, well, now that I know what it is, could it be that I have this, or does my loved one have this? How might you know that you are a candidate for having SIBO?
So there's two ways, by the symptoms you have, and then you can get tested to see for sure if you do. So the symptoms are the same as irritable bowel syndrome. And in fact, up to 84% of those people with irritable bowel syndrome have been shown to have SIBO. The studies don't all agree. The average is about 60%. But so here are the symptoms. They are abdominal bloating, and some people refer to that as abdominal gas. And so therefore, that's also the other symptoms would be when the gas exits, there could be a lot of belching or flatulence. There's constipation or diarrhea or some sort of mixture of the two. And then there's abdominal pain or discomfort or cramping. And then along with that, those are the main four symptoms are bloating, constipation, diarrhea, or a mixture of the two, and pain. And then along with can come things like nausea or GERD, fatigue, food feels like it sits, things like that. So those are the symptoms of IBS. People who have those symptoms and haven't found relief, you know, with proper investigation or treatment, they should certainly consider SIBO. And then the next thing they can do is get tested. And the most common test that we use now for SIBO is called the lactulose breath test. And it's pretty non-invasive and pretty inexpensive, depending upon where you go to get it. And you can even do it at home with a kit, which is quite convenient. And
which is actually what we have our patients doing. I think, truth be told, the instrumentation where you do it in doctor's offices may be slightly more accurate, in my opinion. But because of the inavailability of some of this testing equipment, there are labs that provide test kits where they literally give you bags to blow in after you take a challenge, which you'll describe.
Yeah. So, and I will say that I myself was quite worried about that kit versus in-office. And so we ran a lot of back-to-back tests. And in our looking at it, we found it to be very similar.
Great. That's good news.
So we're pleased about that, at least. But so here's what you do. You know, the way you do it is you for you do a one-day prep diet. Some labs have you do a two-day prep diet, where essentially you're reducing your carbohydrates for the day. And then you fast overnight, a 12-hour fast, and the next morning you drink the sugar solution, which is lactulose. Lactulose is not lactose. They're two different things, because patients always ask about this. And they say, well, if I can't have lactose, can I have lactulose? Well, it's not lactose, but it's a very similar thing, which is that it's not able to be digested by humans. It's only digested by bacteria. So it's meant to be a challenge test. It's meant to feed the bacteria, who are then going to produce gas out of it if they're there, and they should be there in the large intestine at least. And then we'll measure that gas in the breath. And so some people can get worse after the test, but back to how.
Yeah, lactulose is a little bit of a laxative, so it may run through you during the test.
And sometimes after, like later in the day, people experience symptoms. But so then what you do is you sample your breath, you drink the sugar solution, and then over 2 or 3 hours, depending on the lab, you sample your breath about every 15, 20 minutes, and there's instructions for how to do that. And then when it's done, you can begin eating again, and you send your test off. It gets analyzed. And here's what it's analyzed for. It's analyzed for hydrogen and methane gas. And it's always important to talk about that, because not all machinery tests for methane gas. Some of it is a less expensive machinery, and it's very important to test for both. So that's something that when people are asking their doctors about getting the breath test, they should inquire about. And so then those two gases are made only by bacteria, not humans. And based on the time that we see them appear, the samples are timed, you know, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 20 minutes, 40 minutes. That's where we can tell where the bacteria are, if they're in the small intestine or large intestine.
Okay, and is there a difference if you produce a lot of hydrogen versus a lot of methane? You know, methane commonly goes by the name of swamp gas for obvious yeah. reasons, and hydrogen, of course, is colorless, odorless. We don't notice it.
Yeah, there is a difference, and this is one of the most interesting and amazing things to me about all this work on SIBO, and that's that the gases are associated with either constipation or diarrhea. Based on the gas. And so the methane gas has been correlated almost exclusively to cause constipation. This is really incredible brand new information for most physicians, most people. Because previous to this, we've all just been left wondering what causes constipation. We have a few ideas, but this is a cause. So this gas slows motility, causes constipation. Mm-hmm. If there's hydrogen gas, it's more likely there'll be diarrhea. And if there's a combination of the two, it's more likely there'll be that mixed picture, which mm-hmm. can show up in many different ways.
Anyway, people should stay away from an open flame if they have very high... No, I'm just joking.
And the thing is, the treatment's different based on these gases, because different organisms produce these different gases, and so different interventions are needed. That's one of the reasons why the test is so helpful for everybody involved.
Well, okay, so let's say that a person who has all these symptoms, gas, bloating, belching, flatulence, distension, a combination of diarrhea or constipation or both, they then have a positive lactulose breath test. You come from a naturopathic perspective, so clearly you're going to favor a more natural approach. There is a medication out there. Which is the surefire cure for SIBO. In fact, that may be one.
I wish.
Pardon me?
I said I wish.
Yeah, I think, and just for a moment, it's interesting that SIBO is a concept that really kind of languished for many, many years. That is until they developed a drug for it. Now that there's a drug, it suddenly catapulted into popularity among conventional physicians. So now more doctors are testing for SIBO. And I think their philosophy is find a bug, use a drug, and drug sales of this medication have skyrocketed.
Well, I can say that although I would theoretically the most natural approach, with my patients, I don't pick and choose. I use all. I have three main interventions for lowering the bacteria, and I use them all equally. And I just discuss with the patient what's going to be right for them. I really like to figure out what's best for the patient, and so I wind up using a lot of antibiotics. So my three main treatment interventions for lowering the bacteria more quickly are going to be either herbal antibiotics, pharmaceutical antibiotics, or elemental diet, which could also be called elemental formula. And then the fourth option is diet, regular diet, which I use in everybody. And we could talk about how I see this working with people with SIBO, but I can certainly say that, you know, at least in my practice, because I specialize just in SIBO, I wind up seeing quite challenging cases. You know, no one of those approaches is a surefire cure. Although I would say out of all of them, probably elemental formula is the most successful.
Well, that's really interesting. Why don't we go through these different options? First of all, you know, let's talk about Xifaxan, which is the new wonder drug that is being touted as the treatment par excellence for SIBO and hence irritable bowel syndrome. Both of us wish it were so, but I think as practitioners, we both sometimes rely on it. Isn't that the case?
Oh, I use it all the time. It's astonishing, I must say. As antibiotics go, you know, I was taught to not be quite in favor of antibiotics, but as they go, this is about as good as it can get because it's non-systemic, which means it doesn't absorb into the bloodstream. It stays in the intestines, just working right where we want it to. And in fact, it has more of an action in the small intestine than the large intestine, which is quite interesting. So I really like that. It means it's much less prone to cause, you know, urinary tract infections and yeast infections. So I like that. And then second is that it's anti-inflammatory via the PXR gene through NF-kappa B. So quite interesting. A lot of people feel very good when they take this antibiotic. You know, you expect when people take antibiotics that they get terrible die-off, and many people
yes.
do when they're treating SIBO. But at the same time that it's anti-inflammatory, it seems to lessen that. This antibiotic is goes really well for a lot of people. It's really it's about as good as it can get. So I use it a lot, and it's very, very helpful and successful.
Do you believe, and there's some studies on this, that they arbitrarily divide irritable bowel syndrome into two categories. I think that's a little reductive, but they call one category IBS-C, where you're predominantly constipated and you seem bloated and you can't move things along. And then there's IBS-D, which is where you have urgency and diarrhea, the people who can't get out of the house in the morning because they have to go several times, that form of irritable bowel, nervous stomach. It is thought, to my understanding, that Xifaxan or Rifaximin is the generic name. And by the way, weird spelling, X-I-F-A-X-I-N. I don't know where they got that, but it's a weird spelling, like xylophone. That's a good crossword word puzzle word. You get a lot of points
for
that.
It is.
Two X's, a lot of points.
Anything with X's.
Right. But the Xifaxan seems to work better on in my opinion, the patients with the diarrhea component, or do you find that the case?
Absolutely. And there's the third type of IBS, which is IBS-M for mixed. It used to be A for alternating, but then we have the mixed pattern. So I find those distinctions actually quite helpful, and they correlate with the gases. So I mean, really, we could almost replace it with, you know, IBS or SIBO, H for hydrogen, M for methane, and then combo. You know, C for combo would be mixed.
Interesting.
And so it's true. The studies have shown overwhelmingly, and in my clinical experience, absolutely, Rifaximin alone is best for the hydrogen type or the diarrhea type. When a person is constipated or has methane, which is usually the same, then you need Rifaximin plus either neomycin or metronidazole. And those are what the studies have checked. And, you know, what I'm assuming there is that the neomycin or the metronidazole is also called flagyl. I'm assuming that those two are better at targeting the methanogens versus the Rifaximin is better at targeting those that produce hydrogen. And so, you know, I see this all the time. People go to the doctor, the gastroenterologist, they have the methane picture and the constipation picture, and they just get put on Rifaximin alone, and it just doesn't do anything.
Right.
So then they come to me, and it's a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. Just put them on the double antibiotic, bam.
And that's why I think people see specialists like you, because conventional doctors know about Xifaxan, but they tend to be one-note Charlies. They just prescribe the medication. They don't do the additional work with the companion antibiotics, or now you're going to talk to us about herbal antibiotics or probiotics, and also diet modification or elemental formula. Those are additional steps which can increase your chances of success when you're treating this.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the herbals for a minute. So what I do is I think of herbal antibiotics, you know, as an alternative to pharmaceutical antibiotics. I find them to be just about as strong, just about as effective, honestly. I typically see whether it's antibiotics or herbal antibiotics, able to reduce gas levels in one course. One course of antibiotics is 2 weeks. One course of herbal antibiotics is 4 weeks. It takes a little longer. But if we compare the courses, I see that they're both able to reduce gas levels by, on average, about 30 parts per million. And that's really important to know because, particularly for physicians, I try, you know, I do a lot of CE educating of physicians so that you can help your patient to know how many courses are going to be needed if you're taking this approach. Because if somebody comes in with a gas level of 170 or 150, you're not going to get it in 1 2-week course. That's one of the other big mistakes, or so, one four-week course either.
You might do a series of treatments because with each successive treatment, you might progressively diminish the bacterial population.
Absolutely. It gets lower and lower. That's one of the big mistakes I see with, a lot of physicians are making, is that they're just assuming it should all be gone in 2 weeks. So that's a mistake. But let's go back to the herbals. So there's a whole lot of herbal antibiotics, you know, out there in the world. And I think people should feel free to use and try any of them. But I will just share the ones that myself and my associates have been using with really good success. And those are, first of all, we use – is it okay I mentioned product names?
Sure, go ahead, please. Indeed.
Okay. So there's one particular product named AlliMed, and it's the only one I know of its kind that has this high-potency allicin. Allicin is an extract that comes out of garlic. And now, we'll talk about diet in a minute, but I like to use a combination of the specific carbohydrate diet plus FODMAP, low FODMAP diet.
Boy, can we both attest to the fact that we have never spoken before and we're on opposite coasts? We see the same types of patients. And, you know, I got to say it, great minds think alike. I'd like to think so, because I absolutely use SCD and FODMAPs in conquering this condition. And you can explain why that works.
Well, so the reason I was bringing it up right here is because for those familiar with this diet or physicians who are listening, garlic is a high FODMAP. And so one might be afraid to use garlic as an excellent herbal antibiotic. But it can be quite aggravating to a person with SIBO because it can create a lot of gas. Well, this extract, AlliMed, it takes the allicin out of the garlic, and I find it to not be fermentable. So it's handled very well. In fact, it seems to, out of the herbs, to give about the least die-off of all. Mm-hmm. So we use AlliMed, and we use it at either 2 or 3 a day for the 4 weeks. And then we use the berberine-containing herbs. Golden seal is probably the most famous. Berberine is, once again, sort of like a chemical constituent mm-hmm. that's in many herbs.
Yes.
And Organ grape's another one. Coptis is another one. There are products that are, you know, have them all together. So we use that, but we use quite a high amount of this. We use 5 grams a day.
Wow. That may be the key, is to use the high doses.
Use the high amount. Yeah, and we actually, my associate and I, we contacted Stefan Bruner. He wrote Herbal Antibiotics, the book Herbal Antibiotics. So we asked him for his opinion on this, and this is what he recommended. That's why we began using that amount. We've seen it work really well. It winds up being, depending on the product you choose, we've looked for products that you can get the least amount of capsules, you know, get that 5 grams. It winds up being around 10 capsules a day, or if you want to make it a little under 3 pills 3 times a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's the other ones that we commonly use are oregano oil. We often use that in the emulsified form in a tablet.
Yeah, I use a product called Biocidin. Do you find that helpful?
Okay, so Biocidin is a huge combo of different herbal antibiotics. I think it's a wonderful product, and I've been trying it with my SIBO patients for about 7 or 8 months now, and as of yet, I've definitely have one patient that I've seen a before and after test that mm-hmm. it worked the same as the other. Herbal antibiotics we used. But aside from that one person, I haven't seen it work as well as
right.
these other ones.
And when using oregano products, one product that we use goes by the name of oregacillin. Have you explored that particular formulation of oregano?
I haven't. So I can't comment on it, but I have, the one we use a lot is Biotics ADP.
Okay.
Some of my patients use Allergy Research Corporation's oregano oil. I honestly don't think it matters that much. I can't, right off the top of my head, I can't remember the exact milligram or gram amount we use per day.
But it has, oregano has very broad spectrum, suppressive effects on bacterial overgrowth and without the risk of bacterial resistance. And maybe you can explain why, after many rounds of antibiotics, the bacteria may come back like crabgrass and become resistant. And why is it with herbal treatments that might be preferable?
Well, I have to say that I find people getting antibiotic resistance to herbal antibiotics just as commonly as antibiotics. I mean, because this is all I do in my practice.
I see.
For regular, and I do see it. But I see very challenging cases. You know,
yes.
People have been through. So maybe
it's tough being you, because people come probably from all over the country to your center in Portland with the most. You know, they've heard tale about this. They've already been pre-treated, and now they're coming to you on your doorstep because they've failed the simpler treatment protocols.
Yes, and so, you know, why I always try and mention that is that it may, what I'm saying of my own experience may not be true for the first run doc, you know,
right.
Who sees the person first. And so we always have to temper that. But so let me just mention a few other of
please,
the herbal
yeah,
products. Cinnamon is a very good herbal antibiotic. The only thing is it can be a little bit irritating to the mucous membranes over time. It also does help control blood sugar, but it can lower blood sugar a little bit. So, you know, just be careful who you're choosing that with. Maybe not someone who has hypoglycemia terribly. So those are the main ones. And then there's a fifth one we've been using quite a lot of recently, and that's neem.
Oh, and, interesting.
We've been using one called Ayush Neem Plus. And I guess I didn't quite realize this, but you don't really ever find neem just by itself. It always comes complexed with a few other Ayurvedic herbs with it. So that's the one we've been using. We've been using that one at about 3 a day. So
ask you, do you have any experience using peppermint? Because peppermint has both antispasmodic effects in the GI tract, but also somewhat antibacterial. Do you find it helpful?
It's definitely antibacterial. And actually, there's only one published case study or any study on using herbal antibiotics in SIBO, and that's by naturopath Dr. Alan Logan from Canada. And
it's in Alternative Medicine Review, I believe.
Exactly. He did his his study with enteric coated peppermint oil. But the thing is, it has a lower, in his study, it had something like a 40% success rate. Or I can't remember exactly. Don't quote me on it. But it's lower than what I'm finding with the others. I think it's wonderful as an adjunct. And like you said, it can help decrease pain because it relaxes the smooth muscles. But the big problem, really the big problem, is it causes GERD in so many people. Because it is a smooth muscle relaxant, it lowers that lower esophageal, relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter. Now, that can be overcome. You know, you don't lie down right afterwards. It's just that so many people do have difficulty taking it. It's not my first go-to.
Yeah, they're belching peppermint oil, and, you know, they might have heartburn from it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so those are the main herbal antibiotics we tend to use. And, you know, lots of people are doing all sorts of things out there using various combinations. And I just think that's wonderful. I want everyone who's doing that to do some before and after studies and publish it so we can all learn from it.
What about the role of probiotics in the treatment of this? That is often thought to be one of the ways you can rebalance the intestinal tract.
Okay, so this is controversial because what people are worried about is if you're not having a migrating motor complex happen well, then if you put more bacteria down into the small intestine, don't you just worsen the overgrowth?
Right.
This is a valid argument. And honestly, we really don't know the answer. But there are some points I can make. One is, these would be points for why it might be okay. One point is that there have been 3 studies done that used probiotics as a treatment for SIBO, the only treatment for SIBO. So no antibiotics, no herbal antibiotics, etc. They just used probiotics, and they all had some success, some relative success, similar to that peppermint oil study, like, you know, maybe 40% success, something like that. So that puts my mind at ease that it's not harming the situation. In fact, it can help it. Now, I will say that, I mostly use probiotics with everybody. There are some people I don't, but I don't see that kind of results. I don't see 40-50% improvement in someone's SIBO with just SIBO, with just probiotics. Except for the occasional rare person that reports that to me. Oh my gosh, you know, I took VSL, for 1 week and it cured all my problems.
Right.
You know, you occasionally hear this. Mm-hmm. I see more about 25% improvement in symptoms. It's subtle. You know, it's a little help. And so I still recommend it. Now, the other thing why I can say I think I'm not that worried about it is that when you study all the mechanisms of actions of probiotics, there's a lot of mechanisms of actions that could help a SIBO person. For instance, some of them have been shown to stimulate the migrating motor complex, the exact thing we want. And second, they secrete antibiotics, some of which are called bacteriocins, to kill other bacteria. So that would be a help. So I think in general it's a good idea, but there are those people that are quite opposed to it. And there's, you know, somebody was writing on the internet a while ago, and all my patients were asking me about it. Somebody says, you know, you can't ever get rid of your SIBO if you're taking probiotics. Everyone has to stop. Well, then how come I've had 4 years of people that have gotten rid of their SIBO who take probiotics? You know, when people rant like that, they're not giving a broad perspective.
Right. No, and I have to say that you are, as a naturopath, you're not an ideologue focusing merely on natural therapies and trashing conventional therapies. I think you're pragmatist. You seem to use what works, combining the best of both worlds. And I really think that is the essence of intelligent medicine. Let's talk a little bit about, for some, you know, we rattled off a couple of acronyms, SCD and FODMAPs. Talk a little bit about what those diets attempt to do and how they might help SIBO.
Absolutely. So I would figure your listeners are familiar with SCD because you're a big touter of it. Specific carbohydrate diet. And the other one is low FODMAP diet. And the that's just an acronym that stands for a whole bunch of different categories of carbohydrates. That it's FODMAP. And you know, when I first started treating SIBO, I was using the specific carbohydrate diet, and it had really good results for people in reducing their symptoms. What I wasn't finding was I wasn't finding the same sort of results that people with inflammatory bowel disease get. They get, you know, even better results than I was getting for SIBO. And also, I wasn't finding, like Dr. Haas, the original creator of the diet, published, he said, you know, of course he was a pediatrician, and so his patient population were pediatric patients that he diagnosed saying they had celiac, and we could go and talk all about that. That's quite interesting to look back and see, did they or did they not have that disease? But so he said, if you continue the diet 1 year past the resolution of symptoms, then you would be cured and you could go back to eating an unrestricted diet. And I have not found that to be the case in SIBO. First of all, it's a rare person that can become 100% symptom free on SCD.
Correct.
With SIBO, yeah. So, that's why I use other interventions. I haven't found diet alone to do the trick. You know, I see people who come to me 3-4 years strict on SCD or possibly GAPS, that's gut and psychology syndrome diet, just a variant of the SCD. And, you know, we'll run their breath test and they're positive. So I haven't, you know, what I like to think is maybe there are people out there who the diet has cured their SIBO and I just don't ever get to see them. So theoretically, I like to hold that aside, you know. It's, well, just not what I see.
I think the underlying theory with diet change is that, you know, there are different ways to, quote, break the vicious cycle of bacterial proliferation, which is actually, that's the title of a book about specific carbohydrate diet. It's called Break the Vicious Cycle by Elaine Gottschall. But that's directed more towards colitis and Crohn's disease and I guess severe IBS, diverticulitis perhaps. You break the vicious cycle. You can break the vicious cycle by killing the bugs. You can break the vicious cycle by not feeding the bugs the foods that cause them to proliferate. And indeed, diet studies have shown that you can fairly quickly change the flora in the intestine with a diet modification. So, you know, it's...
Absolutely. And so I think, you know, what I think is going on with SIBO is that since the problem is by... So, sorry, I've got a lot of thoughts in my head at once.
Sure.
So you asked, because you asked, what are the underlying ideas here? Both SCD and FODMAPs, what they're trying to do, as you mentioned, is lower the food sources for the bacteria to slowly starve them or at least very much reduce their food amount they can get. And by doing that, Elaine Gottschall was hoping and thinking that then you will reduce and remove the bacteria by starving them. And the FODMAPs people are saying, well, what you're doing is you're not allowing them to produce, you know, as much gas, and gas causes symptoms. So both of these ideas are interesting. What I'm thinking is that, you know, we're not actually treating the underlying cause here, which is the lack of or the deficiency of the migrating motor complex, or the non-draining pockets or the obstruction. And so, that's why I think people can get some symptom relief, but it's not fixing it. And also it's not even removing really enough of the bacteria out of the small intestine, or they would have complete symptom resolution. So it seems as though to me something a little more than diet is needed, but I think diet should still be given to everybody, and I give diet to everybody. I just combine treatments. know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, and then just to finish answering your question on FODMAPs. So FODMAPs, I really love putting these two together, as I heard you do too, because I feel like the FODMAPs researchers have found information that Elaine probably would have eventually come upon anyway. It's almost to me like they've continued that research. And what I think's been missing for a lot of patients in the specific carbohydrate diet is, you know, except for the starchy tubers, all vegetables are allowed, and fruits are allowed. Most all fruits are allowed. But a SIBO patient cannot tolerate just any vegetable and fruit. And there hasn't been a real guidance yet for, well, which ones to try first, which ones might be more problematic. And I feel that that's what FODMAPs can do for us. It gives us that guidance amongst other things too. So I really like the combination.
And just to emphasize, FODMAPs is not so much a diet, it's a guidance. Each of the letters represents a category of foods that the nutritionist or physician and the patient explore together and decide on whether it's in the interest of the patient to eliminate. So F stands for fructans and O stands for oligosaccharides, but you might be sensitive to one and not the other because everybody has a different pattern of intolerance. I think that's the idea there.
Yes, and I really like that. I really like their openness to finding what's right and suitable for each person. I think that's extremely helpful.
Indeed. All right, so a couple of issues that I want to tackle before we end this great podcast. You mentioned the role of elemental diet. Now, that kind of harkens back to the days when we used to give patients Vivanex and,
that's,
you know, very unpalatable,
exactly,
kind of artificial foods, astronaut food.
That's exactly it. Space age nutrition.
Right.
So what has been studied for this condition is Vivanex Plus, exactly what you mentioned. And Dr. Pimentel did that study, and it was extremely successful. One second here. Yeah, so he found a very high degree of people it worked for, and what the concept here is similar to what the specific carbohydrate was aiming at, which is to starve the bacteria. This seems to do a better job. It goes farther. People get confused when they hear the words elemental diet. They think it's a diet. It's actually a formula. It's a powdered formula of all the foods and vitamins we would need, broken down, pre-digested, and put in powder form, and then you mix it with water, and it tastes really bad. And the reason it tastes really bad is because of the amino acids, which when protein's broken down, it's into amino acids. They're very bitter and gaggy and repulsive to most people. So it's difficult because this treatment, because it tastes bad, and you're not eating. This is what you're using for your food. You're not eating for 2 weeks. You use it just like you would pharmaceutical antibiotics.
It's definitely eating to live, not living to eat.
Yes. And so it takes, you know, willpower and resolve. But it's very successful. And, you know, go back to that patient example I was mentioning. Somebody comes in with 150 or 170 gas levels. Well, this is probably going to be their best option because I have seen elemental diet be able to lower, you know, gas levels by like 130 in 1-2 week course, or maybe even more. So it depends, of course, what's right for the patient and at their what time in their life. But if they don't want to be going on with multiple courses of herbal antibiotics or pharmaceutical antibiotics for months and months with a gas level of 170, maybe the 2 week elemental diet might be the best course for them. But the one other thing I must say is that it almost always causes weight loss. The weight loss, in people who are underweight, it's usually temporary or lower weight. It's usually temporary and it comes back nicely. I've seen that in people who have some weight to lose, it stays off. I think it's because the person comes back to a positive equilibrium afterwards.
Could you augment it perhaps with something like a couple of tablespoons of coconut oil, which we know has some antibacterial properties?
Yes, you absolutely could. But you know, still people, well, I tell you, one of the biggest problems is it tastes so bad that they don't drink enough of the calories. But one way or the other, it's about anywhere from a 5 to a 15, often a 15-pound weight loss even within the first week. So people need to know that. And unfortunately, most of the patients, I'd say the majority of patients that come to see me with SIBO are underweight already, actually underweight. So I cannot use this with those patients. It's too dangerous. And one other thing I want to say about it is that Vivanex is expensive.
Yeah.
Very expensive. So is Rifaximin, the antibiotic we talked about. If you don't have
insurance. It's often not covered entirely by insurance. There's a big copay for many patients.
Often not. And both of these can be close to $1,000, depending upon what source you're getting them from, for a two-week course. So what I have done is I made a homemade recipe for Elemental Diet where people buy their own powdered amino acids. And I searched long and hard to find an amino acid formula that matched Vivinex, actually, in its profile. And, then you use oil, like coconut oil, and a carbohydrate source such as honey or dextrose or glucose. And so, we haven't done any formal studies on this, but I have used it with many patients and many of my students have used it, and I find it to work the same, just the same.
So is it a resource that's available to people?
Yes. If you go to my website and you go under the tab Resources Handouts, underneath Resources Handouts, it's right there for you.
Great. SIBOinfo.com.
Yeah, and I just mention it because it's a really helpful treatment for many people, but it could be cost prohibitive if you only think there's just Vivinex available. So I wanted people to know that there's a way to do it at a lower cost.
So you've been very generous with your time, but I'd like to ask you an additional question because we just talked to Sally Fallon, who's a good colleague of yours on the Weston A. Price Board of Directors.
Yes.
And she's written a great book called Nourishing Traditions, and one of her favorite things is bone broth. And it turns out that you have something else in common with her. You're also a big proponent of bone broth. So a couple words about that.
Oh, my gosh. I'm a huge fan of bone broth. I wound up doing my doctoral thesis on bone broth. That was my medical
thesis. That's your claim to fame. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
You know, some people do it on the early works of Chaucer, and other people do it on, ancient, Congolese art. But you did it on bone broth. Interesting.
I did it on bone broth. I actually had to get special permission from my medical college to do it. But I love bone broth, and it can help so many things. But I have to tell you, here's the darn irony, is that it's very aggravating to SIBO patients.
Oh.
And so
okay.
Here I am specializing in a condition that my greatest love, bone broth, is not the best match for.
Right.
So the problem there is that when you make bone broth, you're always making out of bones that have cartilage on the ends of them. Usually.
Yes.
That's standard. And it's the cartilage that causes the problem because there's polysaccharides. These are called GAGs or glycosaminoglycans. And these are polysaccharides. And as we all know from, or maybe we don't all know, but from Elaine Gottschall's work with this specific carbohydrate diet, polysaccharides are ripe, eating food for the bacteria. And so when people have bone broth, they often get quite agitated. Their symptoms get worse. It's unfortunate. So what I recommend is meat only broth, so they don't use bones, they use meat, or get marrow bones. Marrow bones don't have cartilage, and then you could still have bone broth. And then, of course, the big thing would be, let's get rid of that SIBO so you can have some bone broth again.
Right. Let's get rid of the underlying problem, and that's the correct approach. Well, this has been a most illuminating discussion. I've certainly learned a lot talking to you, Dr. Alison Seebecker, and I believe that many of our listeners, some of whom are practitioners, have derived a lot of insight from this discussion, and they can get lots more information because you are very, very forthcoming with your knowledge at SIBOinfo.com. And you recently had an entire seminar on the subject of SIBO. It was like it lasted for a day or two, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a day and a half conference, and we brought top expert in SIBO, Dr. Mark Pimentel, and he told us so many amazing things that anyone who's interested in this can watch it. And we had the public attending and watching as well, so it's open to anyone. And you can find the link to purchase it on my website. I have to update that, actually, but the webinar is recorded. People can watch it.
And also, you are in private practice as well, and patients can consult with you if they want to take a trip to beautiful Portland at the National College of Natural Medicine, the NCNM, one of America's foremost naturopathic colleges, correct?
That's right. Yes, and I actually also do Skype consultations. In that case, I cannot be someone's doctor until I've seen them in person. But
that's good practice. That's the same thing I do because you can't treat people by remote control. I insist that I at least have an initial intake with patients and do an exam and take a detailed history.
Exactly. But, that's so wonderful you're doing Skype, too, because in this age, I think it's so wonderful that people have some specialized knowledge, can consult with those in areas of the country where people don't have that specialized knowledge. And you probably experience this too, but I get to talk to people all around the world, and it's wonderful.
Amazing. What's your most far-flung patient that you've ever treated?
Oh my gosh, let me think. Maybe Tanzania? Is that how you say
okay.
it? But I've had Moscow and, India and just,
I just had a patient from Mauritania, so I thought that was pretty cool.
So neat. Yeah. It's just wonderful. And if you're Skyping with video, what's amazing is, show me the camera outside. Let me see what it looks like,
Exactly. Show me your camel.
Yes.
Well, great. I really commend you for your laser-like focus on this serious problem. And with the techniques that you are bringing to the fore, I think a lot of people can obtain relief from problems that they may not be life-threatening, but they're certainly very seriously life-impairing. People who have chronic SIBO, irritable bowel syndrome, it has devastating consequences for them. So kudos to you for honing in on this.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me on.
It's my great pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, the website is SIBOinfo.com for today's guest, Dr. Allison Seebecker. Thanks for joining us. This is Intelligent Medicine.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce. And so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.